Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Hybrid Jazz is a vision of all that is jazz, both traditional and contemporary, domestic and global. Here's your host, Trish Hennessy.
Well, thank you, Dave. And I have to say that it's an unusual day already. Woo, let me explain to you. You know, there's been a whole lot of stuff that's been happening here at the old homestead in Rosedale, Maryland, just a hoot and a holler down the street from Baltimore. And in the past 24 hours, there has been even more. We are actually living in kind of a war zone because the water heater burst. So you might hear a bit of noise as my main man, Bill, downstairs is cleaning up the mess. We're not sure if the rug's going to be saved, but at least, hey, the house is getting cleaned. You know, there's always a bright side to everything. And honey, we have a bright side for you today. I can't tell you what it means to have the guests that we're having next hour. A Baltimore legend, and then some. I have heard about Gary Bart in Philadelphia when I was living there, and then coming to Charm City here. The questions were relentless when I was working at WSMJ, the full-time jazz station. Oh, is Gary coming back? Have you met Gary yet? He is amazing. He has had some kind of career, and we're going to play the folks that are his connections, a lot of these folks that you'll hear in this show today. And this is the main one, John Coltrane, Lazy Bird from Blue Train back in 1957. This is Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
Thank you.
I'm your neighbor. Don't tread on me. I'm your neighbor. I'm not the enemy. I'm your sister in the global family. Let me live my life, and you can live yours respectfully. Life is much too short to hold a grudge. It makes you old before your time. Do yourself a favor, let go of your fear. The grass ain't always greener on the other side. Just love my neighbor.
Armin Lundy, Love Thy Neighbor, from the 2012 release Changes, that garnered a lot of rave reviews on some charts, not only in the U.S., but globally. Carmen has a tendency to do that. She's had quite a career herself, and hopefully you got a chance to hear her last year when she was on the show. She, I just couldn't believe how humble she is. In different circles that you go into with anybody who has worked with her, especially guys, it's so satisfying to see that men are so taken with how prepared she is for everything. She's got her charts done. She's on time. She's real cordial. She's just such a formidable talent and actually an artist in multiple ways. Anthony Wanzi on piano there. Love that piano picking. Kenny Davis on bass. George Bohannon and Nolan Shahid. Oscar Castro Neves on guitar. Oh, also the 2012 winner of the Thelonious Monk Drum Competition, Jameson Ross, is on the CD, too. That was quite a thrill for him. Now, Carmen is going to be at the Betty Carter Jazz Ahead program in D.C. in the next couple of months. And in case you don't know about this, this is so awesome. Betty Carter made it a point to set this up before she passed on. This is a two-week residency from teen to 25. The new kids on the block as far as jazz is concerned. That's going to be cool. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk to Carmen about that. That would be good. Lee Ritenour, 800 Streets by Feet from Rhythm Sessions, one of those great CDs, again, released just last year. If you want to know what's happening with Lee, go to his website. Very simple, Ritenour, Ritenour.com. You'll learn about six-string theory and the competition he has every year now, and what he's going to be doing at Java Jazz in Indonesia. That's so hot. He's looking forward to that. John Coltrane, Mercy. Woo! Lazy Bird from Blue Train, the only album that Train did on Blue Note, and the only one that garnered, of course, such personal input from him. One of those CDs that you must have if you love jazz at all in your collection. Curtis Fuller on trombone, Lee Morgan on trumpet, Kenny Drew and Paul Chambers and Philly Joe Jones, all part of this glorious project. 1957 was the year, and there are some that speculate about this song, Lazy Bird, because there's some influences, certainly, that have crept into it, but the most legitimate that we can say about this particular track was that John Coltrane had such love and reverence for Sidney Bechet that Lazy Bird closely resembles the second strain of Sidney's Petite Fleur. And maybe Gary Bartz will give us some insight about that, because as much as John Coltrane loved Sidney Bechet, Gary Bartz loved John Coltrane, and that is evidenced on Gary's CD from just last year, and we'll be talking about that. He is such a kick. Woo! Cannot wait. I'm talking fast because I want to fit some songs in, honestly. Gary will be here at the top of next hour, and one of the associations he has made in his life, a deep one, too, because Bartz has played with the big ones. Miles, Mingus, Max, and Woody Shaw, God rest his soul. And I thought it would be cool to play Woody from back in 1983, 12-minute song, Time is Right, on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Thank you all for being here.
Right. is right. Thank you.
love that song from 2008. I'll bet you didn't know who was singing. Swing Out Sister. Remember them? Yeah, from the CD Beautiful Mess. Maybe that's where Lisa McClowry got the idea for the T-shirts and the song. No, she got it from Acoustic Alchemy. But Beautiful Mess, the name of the CD from that magical year. Oh, 2008. So much stuff happened then. Woo, takes me right back. So you know, Swing Out Sister were the folks originally starting out as a trio, then a duo that had the 1986 song hit called Break Out. It was really cool. Corinne Drury and Andy Connell are the basis of the group, and actually, this particular song, Butterfly, made the top five on some of the jazz charts in the U.S. Yes. Swing Out Sister, by the way, actually named after a 1945 film with, some folks will remember him and some folks will not, Arthur Treacher. Arthur Treacher, who played the butler in Shirley Temple movies. He was the sidekick for Merv Griffin, and he had a lovely little seafood chain for a while. And actually, Swing Out Sister, they were deciding on a name, and the only thing that the original three of them could agree on was how much they hated the name Swing Out Sister. So that's what they called themselves. Yes. And Corinne was actually a fashion designer and a model before she became a singer, but that was her calling. Great voice there. Mm. Now, we also heard from Fred Hughes. Fred is one of those guys that has been around forever, handsome man, based in the D.C. area, and I was going to play him a little later, but I've just put out so much music in the way to be programmed today for Gary Bart's tracks here that I think that my studio is moving a little slowly as I go back and forth looking for tracks. So Fred got attention early. And that was called In the Mist, title track from his recent CD. He's going to have a CD release party for you locals at 49 West Coffee House in Annapolis, which is a cool place, just a couple of yards from Ram's Head, right there on the main street, on the 21st of February, just so you know. Fred Hughes, really wonderful guy, great on that keyboard. Oh, my gosh. Definitely want to make that CD release party. There's a lot of those happening. And by the way, if I forget to tell you, I want to make mention of it now. On the 14th, Valentine's Day, we are going to have a really special guest. I'm really excited about this because he will have a CD release party happening on the 16th, 2 days after the interview. And I can't think of a better artist to have for romance, etc., than Tim Green. When I mention that name in some circles, people go, oh, what? Yes, he's going to be on the show, so get ready for that. Now, we also heard Woody Shaw, my gracious, Time is Right from The Time is Right, back in 1983. Beautiful, beautiful album. Just a couple of tracks, longer tracks. Pianist Mulgrew Miller and Stafford James were on that particular track with Woody. And Gary Bartz, our guest, who's coming up in mere moments, knows a lot about those cats because he spent some time with them. And I would imagine that he is going to be talking about Woody specifically because he just mentioned him on my page a couple of hours ago. Some of the local folks were gathering, and Darius Scott, who's having his own little soiree this Saturday at Chef Max, was talking about back in the day before Darius got started on keyboard. He used to make sure he saw Gary play out at some of the clubs and actually at Gary's dad's club in town. That's a whole nother story. And, man, those were some really interesting times that Gary spent with all of these known names. Just a little aside about Woody Shaw, and Cindy Bradley relates to this so well. Woody was 11 and already pretty proficient in music. He has a photographic memory. He's no longer with us. He died far, far too early. But perfect pitch, photographic memory, and Woody was in school, Newark, New Jersey, and he had to pick an instrument. And the last thing he wanted to play was trumpet. No, didn't want to do that. He thought it sounded tinny. And the teacher said to me, well, you can't play violin. Somebody else has that for the band. But I have a good feeling about you and the trumpet. Why don't you pick it up? Well, it became so legendary with Woody and this trumpet. So many people have said that Woody has been their main inspiration. And here's an odd thing. He picked up the trumpet and started to play the month and the year that Clifford Brown died, in June of 1956. So that's pretty wild. This show is going to be pretty wild because Gary Bartz is going to be with us in about 10 minutes. Let's play something, shall we? This is another one of those guys who knew Gary early on. Another one of our guests that we had on the show a few months ago, one of my favorite people on the planet, and it's not just because he's got Atlantic City, New Jersey roots. Harvey Mason from the 70s. Oh, you're going to be hearing a few 70s tracks, yeah. The Mace from Earth Mover on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. The tapes we made back in the 70s, tooling up and down Broad Street in Philadelphia near Temple University. Oh, the stories I could tell you. There's one right there. Music is my sanctuary from the mid-70s, a little bit beyond the mid-70s. Woo! It goes on. Listen. I just love it. Oh, I just love the fact that I could follow Harvey Mason with one of his longtime buddies and partners in music. And it's been great to do this hour with Woody Shaw and John Coltrane. And we'll hear more of the influences and the partnerships that this man has had through the years. My God, there has been many. From the time that he was watching what was going on in his dad's club in Baltimore to being in the Peanut Gallery at Birdland, trying to get in by seeing if he could get some equipment belonging to another musician so he didn't have to pay because he didn't have the money to pay. Going to Juilliard and finding his way to the Jazz Messengers and to Miles Davis, Charles Mingus, Max Roach, and Abby Lincoln. The story goes on and on and on. This is the multiple gifted saxophonist, clarinetist, writer, professor, legend, not only in this city, but beyond, Gary Bartz. Gary, welcome.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm better now. I wanted to hear your voice. Do you know I love your speaking voice so much?
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. You have a natural kindness in your voice that is kind of captivating.
Oh, I appreciate that.
You are so welcome. How much are we taking you away from your busy schedule here? Are you cool to spend some time with us?
I certainly am. I'm ready.
That's wonderful. And I don't even know where to begin. Actually, we could do about, 6 hours or so. Because we're talking about over 5 decades of a career, Gary. Isn't that amazing when you consider that?
It is. I can remember when I first started, really being serious. Well, I was always serious, but I would look and see, I'd say, wow, Miles has been playing for 40, 50 years. Hope I can get there, and I'm here.
You are. Wow. And that is really true, isn't it? I mean, you really were at Birdland. You're a youngin'. I mean, you were, 17 or so? And you couldn't legitimately be in there because you had to be 21. But, I mean, you were watching all these beautiful people pass through, and you became one of those beautiful people, Gary.
I know. But actually, I had been going to Birdland probably from the age of 14 because
Jeez.
You could, if your parents could, you know, you could go with adults.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you were allowed. And then they had what they called the Peanut Gallery, and that was where the young people could sit and no alcohol was served. So they did make arrangements for young people, which I think is very important because if you want to continue this great music, you have to have the young people involved.
Oh, definitely.
The younger in age, the better.
Yeah, and it's funny you should mention that because I didn't know I was going to play Carmen Lundy a little while ago, and I see on her tour schedule this year that she's going to be part of this really cool thing that they have that's based at the Kennedy Center in D.C. It's the Betty Carter Jazz Ahead program. And it's these young kids from their teens to 25. Betty planned this before she passed on. She wanted to make sure that baton got passed to the young kids.
Yeah, that's very important. And speaking of Betty Carter, she was my next-door neighbor for about 4 or 5 years.
Was she?
Yeah, in Brooklyn, yeah.
Oh.
That's one of my favorite people.
Oh, my. You know what? There's a couple of people in this crowded chat room today that would say exactly what you said, because she really... And you and she were cut from the same cloth, because you are very strong about feelings about jazz and the state of jazz. And let's get right to it, Gary. What do you perceive of the state of jazz these days?
Well, I don't use that term, jazz.
Okay.
The question might better be posed, what do I think about the state of music? Because it's music. It's not. See, jazz and rock and pop and hip hop and all of that's man-made. That's from your mind. That's only something set up in your mind. What it really is music. And so if you want to put yourself into a corner, then you can be a jazz person and be in the jazz box, you know. But that's confining. And all of the great musicians that I've had the privilege to be associated with all felt the same way, and I kind of learned that and grew up seeing that. If I were just, say, a so-called jazz musician, I may never have done music as my sanctuary.
That's correct.
You know what I'm
saying? Yes. So
I can't be confined by mind-made terms. I, you know, the universe is music. I mean, Sufis say that the Big Bang was created because the sound got so loud and it hit that resonant sound and everything exploded, and it's been going ever since. That's their theory. So sound is very important. And to say that it's this, you can't compartmentalize it. I can't, anyway.
Listen, why do you think this show is called Hybrid Jazz? Because you were one of the first hybridists. Really were, because, oh my God, you know, you and I are not that far apart in age. I'm 60. So you and I grew up in a time when music was... we were absolutely reverent about music. And Gary, now thinking back on it, we were so blessed to have that those kinds of influence creep into our soul.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking the other day, prior to maybe 20, 30 years ago, the community chose who the great musicians were. Not the media.
Yes.
Not the corporations. Nowadays, corporations tell the public who's good, who's not. Before that, the public went and they co-signed whoever was. So I think it's a different thing. I think you tend to have more quality when the public is choosing rather than when the media or corporations are choosing who you should like or who you should listen to.
Oh, you are certainly preaching to the choir, because, you know, having been in radio since 1976, I would always hear from male program directors that they thought that the listening public was stupid, so they had to be told what was fed to them.
Right. Yeah.
And you've gotten a taste of that through the years, because, you know, you've had to face some battles, as we all did. For those of us who were on the other side of the microphone, the disc jockeys, and listening to our brothers and sisters who were out there trying to create some original music, really tricky to get that played sometimes on the radio. So now... You know, we've had to branch out and do the online radio shows, because terrestrial radio, which was once glorious, is not that glorious anymore. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think with the internet and the social media today has made a new grounds. We have new grounds. And I think a part of it is the doing away with the record labels, because the record labels were, at first they were, you know, they started, the independents would start because they really loved the music, you know, so they were playing like Blue Note, you know, Monk and people who no one else was touching, you know. They recorded these great musicians. And then it got to a point where it was a money thing. And so now they need, you know, to heck with a great musician. They need somebody who's going to sell. And, of course, they're in marketing, so they know who's going to sell or what's going to sell, so they think.
Right.
And to their detriment, they ruin their own selves. I think they're more responsible for the demise of the record labels than anything or anybody else. It was the record labels themselves, because their whole deal, if I'm signing with a record label, the deal is I'm going to give them the best music that I can, and their deal, their obligation is to sell it, which they never did. But there's a reason why they didn't, especially with this particular music, because this music has a long shelf life.
Yes.
It's in perpetuity, I'll be listening to Monk and Miles, and people will be listening to them, you know. So, but, man, I don't want to throw any names out, but a lot of the pop artists, if you don't sell them right away, that's it. You know, they may not sell anything. So because we have a long shelf life, they don't have an urgency to market this music. And even more important, something that I realized a few years ago, is that when we pass, then it's all clear. It's all gravy for them. So I was actually in business with people. I had signed a contract with people who thought and think I'm more valuable when I'm dead than when I'm alive. And that's something that I could not fathom. So I had to get out of the industry. I had to get out of that part of the industry anyway. I like to tell people, you know, I tell a lot of musicians, I'd say, you think you're in the record business. You are not in the record business until you own a master publishing or you own something.
That's
you
right.
are working for people who are in the record business.
Oh, yeah. And haven't we heard the stories through the years of our great ones who were left penniless because they did not know that?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. You have such a reputation in town, you know, living in Baltimore, being a Philadelphia girl and then living in Baltimore. I certainly knew about you back in Philly. But here, you must have gotten a little taste of it in the past few days when I've been talking about you being on the show, because I get questions all the time about you. For whatever reason, people perceive of me as, well, Trish knows, ask her. But, you are so revered, and I know that it's part of the fact that you were so tied to your dad's club. Isn't that a tickle for you? You are known as one of these people who other folks not only revere, but you're discussed in so many circles because of the kind of work that you've had through the years. Gary, you've never wavered from the kind of quality work. Your passion has always been at the surface. And even though some records sold more than others, everybody agreed that your heart is 150% behind whatever you do.
Well, and that is true, though. And I'm surprised, you know, at the notoriety that I do get from Baltimore. But, I mean, that's my town. That's where I was born. Baltimore is really a great town, even though I had many problems growing up with the city of Baltimore, simply because it was segregated when I was growing up there.
Yes, yes.
And I experienced many negative things, which made me, when I got to the eight, when I graduated high school, I hightailed it out of Baltimore.
Mm.
I couldn't wait to get out of it. Because I was going to, you know, I can't take injustice. I'm a Libra. And
so am I.
You're a Libra too? What day are you?
October 16th.
Oh, okay. You're
right
the
26th on. Of September.
Is he? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I really had to get out of there and move. I wanted to go to New York anyway. But the fact that I was not happy living in a city that was so, well, that was segregated.
Yeah.
That was, I really disliked it. And it's amazing that now I'm back. Baltimore, I'm back.
And what does exactly that mean? When you say you're back, what does that mean?
Well, I'm beginning to appreciate the city.
Oh, good. Okay.
As I never had. And I never appreciated it other than it was a great music city when I was growing up. I mean, we had the Royal Theater, we had the Comedy Club, we had the Club Casino, we had all these places. We could the Tijuana, Peyton Place, you know, and I saw many great, you know, musicians who I later, you know, went on to perform with and get to know. But every week there was great music. So they're very fond memories as well as the negative memories. And it's good to see the city has grown up.
Oh, my gosh. Has it ever? I'm like you. I couldn't. I mean, it didn't matter that Baltimore was, you know, below the Mason-Dixon line back in those days, because Philly was just as much being where it is as a segregated town in many ways. Didn't really matter. It was just the climate of those times. But my God, Gary, Baltimore is just so diverse. I love melting pots. I love it when different cultures get together and make music or make food or share neighborhoods. Oh, it is just full of that in Baltimore now. So you'd be absolutely thrilled.
Yeah. No, I am. I've been visiting Baltimore regularly lately.
Good. Yay. Well, you know, here's the thing. I don't even know when it began for you. I know that you went to Juilliard when you were, 1958, so you were about 17. And to go to Juilliard is such a blessing. But how did it spring forward from there? You were in New York, you're going to Juilliard, and what was the big thing that happened first after that experience?
After that, well, let me go before that.
Yeah, please.
Because at the age of six, I knew I wanted to play this instrument that I later found out was called the alto saxophone.
That's so exciting.
I had heard at my grandmother's house where my uncle lived, and his name is Leon Bartz, and they called him Sharp Bartz because he would always go to New York to listen to the musicians and buy the latest clothes and come back, and he was sharp. He was always sharp. he had the Charlie Parker records, the Louis Jordans, the Dizzy Gillespies, and he would tell me these stories about them. And so starting from the age of six, I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I've been studying music for since then.
Yes.
Since the age of six, because you can study music without an instrument. You can practice without an instrument. You don't need your instrument to study music. But that really got me started. It took me 5 years to convince my parents that I really wanted a saxophone. And so when I became, when I turned 11, I got my first saxophone one Christmas. And
1951, right? 1951,
right, yeah. And started studying and trying to by then I had made in my head, I knew what I wanted to sound like. I knew how I wanted to play. I knew what directions I wanted to go in. So I had a 5-year head start, you know, because the proper way to learn music, I think, is by ears. Ears, if I hadn't ever heard the music, then I wouldn't have known. You know, your ears are before anything. So if ears are before anything, I mean, Mozart was writing music when he was 3 years old. He couldn't write his name, you know, so his ears could hear that. So it's ears, and that's something that I try to teach at Oberlin, where I teach Oberlin Conservatory of Music. And I notice most of the young musicians coming in, their ears are locked.
Really?
And yeah, their ears are so locked. And they know it. Once I point it out to them, they know it, and they want to know, what can I do? But it's because they started learning music by the page. They started reading first. I didn't start reading first. I started listening first. And so, you know, that's the proper way. That it's backwards now. The musicians will be just as great, if not, you know, they'll be just as great, but they have to do everything backwards. Now they have to open up their ears. They have to learn how to listen. They have to learn how to hear rather than to trust. I mean, if I ever see musicians, whenever I see musicians, it's a big thing with me. If I see musicians on stage and they're reading music, that means one thing to me, that they don't know the music. I mean, no band I ever was in, unless it was a big band, read me. We didn't have music. Max, we never had music. We would rehearse songs, you know, in the morning, and that night we were required to remember it. So that taught us how to remember things, really quick. And I say, you know, I wouldn't want to go to see a play and watch the actors reading from the script.
That's a point.
You know,
yeah.
Or to go to the movies, you know, and somebody forgets their line, they got to go over and look at the script. You know, I don't want to see that.
You know,
I mean, if they can learn all of these words, we can't learn the music. So, you know, that's my thing. You don't read music on stage. Max said, you know, that takes away the magic, you know.
Wow.
Now, it got to a point, like, in the 30s, 20s and 30s, a lot of the public, especially the white public, would say, well, the black musicians don't know how to read, you know, and all of that. Of course they did, but they didn't need to because they remembered it. So, but it got to the point where they said, well, okay, we'll put music up there like we're reading it. You know, so the Count Basies and Fletcher Henderson's, Chick Webb's, and all the bands, they would have music up. They knew the music. They didn't need to read it. They already knew it, but it was for show.
Oh, my gosh. And you know what? That makes me furious because it's what that they had to do in order to appease the white public. Wow.
Right. Well, I saw, you know what I saw one time on TV? I saw Louis Armstrong performing. I don't know what show. It could have been Ed Sullivan or something like that. But they came on and the band got on their knees and put handkerchiefs on their heads, and they played a number or two. I was furious. I went back the next time I saw Max Roach. I said, Max, you, my Uncle Tom, Louis Armstrong, I can't stand him. Oh, my God. He said, no. He said, you must not have heard what he said before he did that. And what he said was, this is the only way we could perform before a white audience was to get on our knees and put a handkerchief on our head. So I was actually looking at a history lesson.
Wow.
But that's what they had to go through. You know, from that moment on, you know, I had a whole different outlook on things.
Yeah, and you know what? Louis Armstrong was the I've been thinking about this for years because I remember seeing him so often on TV. And he always had that smile on his face. And I knew even when I was a little girl, I thought, he doesn't mean that smile. He's putting that smile on because of all the BS that he had to endure when he was coming up. My God, one of the worst kinds of childhood ever. And the kind of prejudice that he encountered, but he knew that in order to mentally survive, he had to do this.
Yeah. I think the smile was partly that, but I think it was also the joy of his music.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
so it was an honest smile, I think, also.
One of the most loving spirits that ever walked the earth. Lord have mercy.
Oh, no question.
Well, and I was so digging. Man, I've been going through the Gary Bartz catalog for the past few days, and I actually made a list of every single album you've ever done from 1967 and Libra with my buddy Kenny Barron, who I just love so much, all the way to 2000.
Well, no, Libra was with Albert Daly.
Oh, Kenny wasn't on that?
No, that was, I don't think, well, no, I knew Kenny then, but no, that was my good friend from Baltimore, Albert Daly, one of the, probably the greatest pianists I've ever known.
Really?
Albert Daly. And they never talk about Albert, so let me talk about Albert right now.
Oh, yeah, please.
Baltimore's own. I went to the Royal one time, I was still in high school. And I used to go right after school let out, and, you know, they would have maybe five or six shows a day. I don't know who it was. Could have been Fats Domino, could have been Lou Richie, could have been James Brown, could have been, you know, because it was a mix. But I'm sitting there, and I'm watching the big band that would play behind the different acts. And I see, you know, as an older piano player. And I see this young kid come in, and he's about my age, and he sits down on the piano stool, and the guy that was playing just scoots off on the other end, and this young kid starts to play. That was Albert Daly.
Hmm.
He was probably, 16 or 17 at that point. But he, you know, we went on to meet and perform together, and actually he lived with me for a little while. Greatest, I'm telling you, this man. Ask any piano player about Albert Daly. Anyone who knows, from Mulgrew Miller to Kenny Barron to you name it, they all will genuflect to Albert.
Even McCoy Tyner?
McCoy knows, yeah, he knows about Albert. As a matter of fact, John Coltrane had asked Albert before he asked McCoy.
Oh, that's the piano player.
Yeah, Albert had done a couple of weeks in Washington, D.C. with John's quartet, and John fell in love with him, as everybody did. And so he was asked before, but at the time he was working with Tamita Joe, and so that was a very good paying job. And he had kids, so he and for the rest of his life, though, he regretted that decision.
Did he really?
Oh, he did. He would talk about that, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's something, because I remember several years ago now, I had heard that there was a piano player that Train was really, really fond of, but he had also promised McCoy that when McCoy was ready, he was going to jump in.
Right.
And, man, you're still living that story with McCoy. You're going to be doing some dates in New York next week, right?
Yeah, Tuesday and Wednesday. I think that's the 12th and 13th.
That's
yeah.
So awesome.
Blue Note.
Oh,
we were actually supposed to be at the Regatta Bar this Friday and Saturday, but this blizzard has put a damper on that.
Oh, doggone it.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be a reschedule, though, right?
Yeah, I think they have an April date. I'm not sure, but it will be rescheduled.
Well, can we play? I am so taken with just rekindling my spiritual romance, if there can be such a thing, with Gary Bartz. So, of course, you know, I've gone back to some albums that I had known from many years ago, but I got to know in the past many weeks Coltrane Rules, the Tao of a Music Warrior.
Mm.
And I really am digging, because you asked me this the other day via message on Facebook. Okay, I'm just going to find out what you like. So
yes.
One of those tracks on this, your latest from just 2012, is a song called Bird Train.
Oh.
I love that.
Thank you.
So it doesn't take rocket science to figure out what the song is about, but how did that come to be?
Well, it's a song that's based on Confirmation, which Charlie Parker wrote, the famous Confirmation. And John Coltrane then put his stamp on it by using his Giant Step Changes over Confirmation. So that's why it's really a combination of a Charlie Parker tune and a John Coltrane tune. So that's why I call it Bird Train.
And tell folks, because I know that we've got a lot of folks in Baltimore who are listening, but also music aficionados from all over the world will be hearing this live right now or in the archives. So tell us how much you appreciate these cats that you're playing with on this album, because you really have this immensely magical chemistry.
Well, it's a funny thing. My take on the industry, they don't want bands. There was a time when I was coming up where there were bands. You had Clifford and Max, you had Miles, you had Horace Silver, you had so many great bands. And so, like, you know, and then the records would come out and you'd learn. So when I joined Art Blakey and the Messengers, I already knew the book because I knew all the records. I had learned it, you know.
Right.
So I never rehearsed. We never had a rehearsal. With Art Blakey, we never had a rehearsal.
Oh,
I
wow.
learned all of the music on stage. The songs that I didn't know. So for instance, Lee Morgan, who was in the band, he helped get me in the band, he and John Hicks. We'd be ready to hit the stage, and Lee would come up and say, "Bart, you know this song?" And I would say, "No." He would say, "Well, here, let me play it for you." And I'd have to learn it right before we were going out on stage.
Man.
And we'd go out and play it, you know. But this is what I'm saying. This is why ears are so important.
Yeah.
You know, as musicians, if you don't have an ear, I don't even know whether you, well, no, I shouldn't say that. But you have to have an ear. You must have an ear. And I might not play it correctly. I might not have played it correctly the first time, but by the end of the song, I would know it. You know, because you're studying it while it's being played, you know. And I forgot what your question was. I went away.
It's okay. I knew this was going to happen. And you had mentioned this before about your students and picking up that your students aren't, you know, they don't know about hearing by ear because they're going by their sheet.
By the written. Yeah.
But I
know what the question was. I know what you asked me about my band.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we were talking about bands. So it's very important to have a band. A band is a laboratory to do your experiments. That's why no innovation in music has ever come about unless it was through a working band. Be it Duke Ellington, Count Basie, be it Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Art Blakey, you name it, Max Roach, Clifford Brown. It has to be a working band. And it takes about 2 to 3 years for a band to really get to a point where they know each other so well and are experimenting and coming up with new concepts. It takes about at least 2 years, sometimes longer. But I've always had a band. That's very important to me. I will sacrifice to keep a band, even though the industry keeps trying to put me with this guy and that guy, and let's do this. I just got a call today, and they want me to come, I won't even mention where, but to this festival, and they want me to perform with the musicians there, which I don't have a problem with that, but I have a band. And if the audience wants to hear your music at its best, they need to hear it with your band.
Yes.
Because if I go and play with some other guys, it's more like a jam session.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can. But if you want to hear what we're really into and what we're really doing, you need to hear the band and see the experiments and to see what we're up to.
And oh,
yeah. So this band, I've had this band almost 10 years we've been together, at least, and you know, guys, the latest addition is Barney McCall, who I met in Australia, great pianist and composer. Greg Bandy, of course, everybody knows Greg, the mayor of Harlem, he calls himself. One of the great unsung, I mean, he's got a style unlike anybody you ever want to hear. He's raw, but he's just, I mean, I love that rawness that he brings to, you know, the creative process. And, of course, James King, who... And I've always felt like that the bass is probably the most important person in the band, and that's the one person that gets neglected.
Yes.
Even though I feel they're the most important, because that's the glue.
Yeah.
He's from the Baltimore, Washington area, of course. He's from Houston, but he's lived here for many years. And I love this band. We can't wait to play, perform. Every night that we perform, it's just love. That's what it is.
And see, that's what you always wanted to do. You always wanted to foster that notion of love and unity. And I think that's why you're so beloved. But now I'm picking up on why else people love you so much, Gary. You really do love to wax poetic about other artists. You really do. That's so awesome. You don't have the forum to grab the spotlight yourself. You want to make sure that other folks get known, and that's a beautiful thing. And so is this song. This is just one of those crown jewels. I love it. From Coltrane Rules, the Tao of a Music Warrior, Gary Bartz, and Bird Train on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
Thank you.
Gary Bartz and wonderful company, Bird Train from Coltrane Rules, Tao of a Music Warrior. Gary, I have to tell you, you know, the wonder of your playing is that, and I've listened to some tracks now over and over again, and recently knowing that you were going to be on the show, you have a way of making what is essentially free form. I've listened to so many musicians through the years that are so free with their particular instrument, and they can't ever reel me back. You have a way of being so engaged with being in love with people who are listening to you that you always bring them back. It's like the invitation is always there. I'm out here, and I want you to follow me, but I want you to come with me. And I don't want you to leave. I just want you to trust me as to where I'm going.
But you know what it is, I think, is that we've been tricked once again by these words. Words and thoughts are just things. A thought is only a thing. It's not real. You know, you can make it real if you work on it. But I'm not an improviser. I'm not improvising, because improvising. Let me go. Let me just say this. I've been showing this to my students.
Okay.
These are some of the definitions of improvise. Okay. Offhand, spur of the moment, unplanned, unpremeditated, unprepared, unrehearsed, unstudied. Those are definitions of improvisation. We don't improvise. We compose. It's a composition. Everything that I play, I intend to play that, be it a second before I play it. But whatever it is, that's what I plan to play. It didn't just pop out of nowhere. I've studied these things. I've worked on it so that I have all these ideas and ways of playing and ways of doing different things, and then I try to make it into a complete composition. So, and any composition has a great ending. It has good material in the middle using themes and thematic material, and it has a great ending, you know. So that's a big difference from someone improvising. The only time that I improvise is when I make a mistake. And that's off the top of my head, because I didn't plan on that. that was unprepared. But
well,
everything else is prepared.
Then that's even more glorious what you do, because you've got such zest or such boundless soul when you are playing that it makes people believe they have just seen the spark of creativity happen over and over again. So you are a freaking master. Wow. And I know how strongly you feel, because, you know, when you were listening to your uncle's records back in the day and deciding at that early age that you wanted to play sax, you said that you found out the right way to do it. So I know that that's pivotal for you in your growth as an artist through the years. But you, bottom line is, here's what it is, Gary Bartz. You make it look easy.
that's all day, because you don't see me in the house all day working on all this stuff.
You're right.
You know, yeah, the culmination, that's the fun part. You know, the work part is by yourself, you know, this doing, working on the music and studying. That's the hard part. And it's also the fun part, too. I love doing that. I mean,
yeah.
I look at it like a mining. I like to say I'm like the seven dwarfs or somebody going out, hi-ho, here we go. And I go and I might practice, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day. And I might, in those 8 hours, I might find something, a gem, a nice big load of gold or something, or a diamond that then I can use for the rest of my life in my music. You know, I've learned something that will embellish what I'm trying to do. So that's why the mining, you know, you might do 8 hours and come out with one thing, but then you have that for the rest of your life. So,
Wow.
Yeah,
I just am so taken with how your spirit is so generous. You really haven't changed much from when you were in your 20s doing those beautiful records back then. My God, I've known Rivers and Other Bodies and Cinderella and Follow the Medicine Man and Juju Street Songs. You really do want to interject in society a sense of peace and a sense that we really are like one people. That's what
yeah.
I get from you.
Yeah, that's true. Somebody was saying, I forget what it was, but they were saying what they felt they were, you know, and I said, well, I'm an earthling. I look at myself as an earthling. You know, you can say, well, you know, I'm white, I'm black, I'm Native American, I'm this and that, but we're all earthlings. And so just, you know, I mean, I look at the broader sense. Just the same thing is with jazz and rock. It's all music. I don't need all of that other stuff. That's extra. And then that starts to compartmentalize things. And once you start dividing things, now you got problems. If we all looked at ourselves as humans or earthlings, we would have no problems, because we wouldn't see the colors. We'd see the colors, but it would say, oh, wow, that's a pretty color.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, rather than, oh, I don't like that color. Those colors are not good people. You know, I mean, but that's what we're taught. We don't know this as young kids. We're taught this. Kids don't see it.
Oh, I know. And, you know, it's a big difference. We've talked about this a time or two between being tolerant and being embracing. You know, children have to learn, if they're not learning it at home, but they have to learn it in school. It's not just a matter of, well, you're okay, I'll tolerate you. But no, I embrace you because I love your color. I really love your color. I appreciate all of who you are, not just some of who you are. I dig everything about you.
Yeah. That's true. And also, I wanted to say that I think of myself a lot of times as a music activist, because there was a point in the 60s when I felt, you know, we were struggling, you know, for civil rights. I felt like, well, the world doesn't need another musician, you know. I mean, we've got a bunch of those, you know. But in talking to Mingus and the Max Roach and being around Duke Ellington, people like that, I saw a way to utilize the music to better society.
Yes.
And I think that's important. So I think Max was definitely a music activist.
Oh, yes.
Mingus was, Duke Ellington was, I mean, Louis Armstrong. I think, you know, most artists are. It would be whatever their medium is, that's foremost in their minds, I think.
And actually, you know what? Those artists that you mentioned use the anger that they had creatively for good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's right. A big difference when you are able to channel and keep that contained, because I would imagine that there were times when, you know, so many of our beautiful ones left this country to live in Europe because they couldn't stand it anymore. How could you possibly sell out a venue and not be able to stay at the hotel or drink at the water fountain? That makes no sense.
Yeah.
And to keep your sanity, so many of the people that we both revere left, and then they did come back, but so many were able to channel that anger and that rage into something that was so positive that we're still high even after all these years from them.
Yeah, that's true. I remember there was a club. I'm not sure where that club was. It might have been, it was on the east side somewhere. It's called the Surf Club. I don't know if you've ever heard of that club.
Yeah.
But, well, that particular, I worked there one night with Erskine Hawkins.
Wow.
I was subbing for somebody. And I had heard about it. Cannonball refused to work there, Dizzy refused, because the musicians couldn't come in the front door. This is Baltimore now. If you couldn't come in the front door, there was a bar they had in the back that we could socialize back there, you know, and have drinks or whatever. But we couldn't go out and socialize with the audience that had paid to come see us perform, which was, I mean, those are some of the memories of Baltimore that are negative memories, but that those things happen. And in a way, I'm glad I did see that. I didn't see the Cotton Club in the 20s. You know, I'm not that old. But the same thing happened there, you know, where the white audience would pay to come in to see these great shows, you know, with Duke Ellington and the dancers and everybody. But they couldn't socialize with the audience, which is like, I mean, you know, it's like a zoo. That reminds me of a zoo.
Oh, well, you know? Well, and you're exactly right with that kind of analogy, because, you know, there's a line of demarcation. Here are the humans. Here are the animals. It's just obscene.
Yeah, like with the dancing bears. Here come the seals next.
Man, I'm just so glad that you are turning out music, and you sound so wonderful and so warm and so full of life, and I know that there's a minute to go. This hour flew by.
It did.
It really did. What was? Tell me a wonderful time in your life, one of your best memories. I know that winning the Grammy with McCoy back for Illuminations was fabulous, 2005. But is there a time in your life that you sometimes you get a little pang in your stomach because if you could go back, you would?
I don't think I would want to go back, but I do have good memories. I mean, anytime I was playing with Lee Morgan was a good memory. Anytime. and I've been fortunate, you know, to play with some of the greatest trumpeters, from Blue Mitchell to Miles to Dizzy to Kenny Dorham. You know, it's so many great memories. I could say the Isle of Wight with Miles in 1970. When we came out on the stage, and as far as your eyes could see, there were people. There was over 500,000 people there. Things like that, you know. But I wouldn't want to go back. I hope that these things could be recreated again.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
You're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing now. Thank God you have you are the blessing in being the professor. These kids who are learning from you, that means everything. Do you really enjoy what you're doing now? That's so great.
I do, and it's funny because I went into academia kicking and screaming.
Did you?
I did not. I mean, I did not want to do that. I know my parents would always say, well, you got to go to school. You got to have something to fall back on, you know. And my take on that was, I didn't want a net. I didn't want that safety net because I might use it, and I might not work as hard with that net. And so I kept avoiding because I had been asked many times, you know, to teach. And finally I said, okay, let me do it. And I really love it. I really do. Because not only do I love it teaching, but I'm learning from the students. I'm still learning. I mean, you can learn from anybody. And I'm learning as much as teaching, so we're learning from each other.
Well, you're incredibly patient, and that means a lot.
I've been called that many, many times.
Yes. Is that right? You're very gentle, and you take the time to explain. And for as an astute of a talent as you are, you know, there's many people who do not have the patience, don't want to even display any patience because they don't tolerate fools easily. But you see the broader picture, and you have mentioned how important it is to see these young ones learn the right way, the way of loving kindness, if you will. And you just are walking what you're talking. So you're a big, fat blessing, Gary Bartz.
Oh, thank you, Trish. I appreciate that.
You are welcome. And I've kept you over a few minutes. You had asked me the other day, you said, okay, you pick. I want to see what you like. And I'm going to end this with something from the Red and Orange Poems album.
Okay.
I love Soulmate.
Oh, I do too. My good friend John Lucien. Yeah.
Yes. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece, and I could tell your heart was so in it. Your heart always is, but sometimes you can feel a personal connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt it with that.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yep. So again, let's tell folks, if they're going to be in the New York area, this is going to be some kind of connection because you and McCoy have known each other for a long time.
Oh my goodness, since the early 60s. Yeah. When he was working with the Jazz Tet, Benny Golson and Art Farmer's Jazz Tet. Yeah.
Once again, it's that Philly-Baltimore connection. You can't get away from it.
That's right. Well, they're sister cities. You know that.
Yes.
I mean, for me, they're sister cities. I lived in Philly for a little while myself.
Yep.
Great music towns.
Oh, my God, the best. I mean, this 95 corridor is the smackdown as far as music is concerned. You go one way, there's Virginia, D.C. You go the other way, there's New York and Philly. You can't lose. And New Jersey,
that's
for
right.
The love of God.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Gary. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have you. And anytime you just want to come back to the show and just hang, you have an open invitation.
I thank you very much, Trish. I had a wonderful time.
Great. And McCoy and you are going to be next Tuesday and Wednesday, right?
Tuesday and Wednesday at the Blue Note in New York on 3rd Street, West 3rd, right off of 6th Avenue.
And you've got a Full Tilt Boogie website, and folks can pick up what you're doing from there. So, again, I thank you, and I will see you down the road sometime this year.
Okay. I look forward to it.
All right, Gary. Bless you.
Bless you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The amazing Gary Bartz, everybody. And thank you all for being in the chat room and listening. I imagine that Blog Talk Radio will have some kind of stats this week because this is not to be taken lightly that Gary Bartz was on the show. I really appreciate that. And his music to the nth degree. Because many of us can attest that this has been the soundtrack to a large extent of our lives. And this is going back not that far, 1994 or thereabouts. This is Gary and his always sublime company, Soulmate, from the Red and Orange Poems. Little Dreaming on the Niger. Yes, the amazing Regina Carter from her Reverse Thread album from a few years ago now. Two. All right, we'll say two. And is it? Or maybe three now. Just a wonderful idea to bring together what was and still is amazing in African folk melodies, bringing the kora and the accordion into the mix and seeing what kind of jazz can be created with that kind of glorious background that Regina has, who's just considered to be one of the great violinists of our time. And I was looking at her schedule. It's so crazy. She's going to close the Laguna Beach Music Festival on Sunday when she performs with the Pablo Ziegler Classical Tango Quartet, don't you know? And then later this month, she's going to be at the Lionel Hampton International Jazz Festival. She's going to be with Yashiri Aki when Yashiri does Birdland for the first time. And then in a few months, Regina will be in the Washington, D.C. area because she will be part of the Mary Lou Williams Jazz Festival. So that's good news and a lot for us to look forward to. And I have to tell you something, and I have mixed feelings about saying this. We heard Donald Byrd after we heard Gary Bartz, and there's so much commotion in this house, I'm hoping I played the right track. But I by a hair, I shortchanged Gary a note or two of that song that you heard. And then I went into Donald Byrd, who Gary spent some time with back in the 70s. Donald Byrd, Ghana, from Byrd in Flight on Blue Note, and Hank Mobley on tenor sax, Duke Pearson on piano, Doug Glockens on bass, and Lex Humphreys on drums. Now, the other day, Winston Byrd got the information that Donald Byrd had passed away. Now, in a matter of hours, Winston said, I have to retract that. Apparently, it was a hoax. Donald Byrd has not passed away. Then, right before the show started today, one of our great disc jockeys in town posted on his page that Donald had passed. So I wrote to him and said, you know what, I don't know what the source is, but you may want to check on that because it could be a hoax. I didn't want to mention anything to Gary while he was with me. So my friend wrote back and said, I have it on good authority from somebody who's in the family that he has passed, but for whatever reason, they don't want to necessarily come out publicly and say that. So don't be surprised by anything you hear. For whatever reason, for the past few years, saying something about Donald Byrd passing has been a hoax for people with far too much time on their hands. So I don't know the official word yet. Until I do, we won't lament. We'll pretend that it's indeed one of those stupid little things that gets on the internet. Somebody said the other day, and I have to agree, somebody said that the internet is like the bathroom wall. You can put anything you want on there, and you'll see what sticks. Anyway, and a beautiful piece of work by Donald Byrd from Byrd in Flight, 1960, Ghana, all about the liberation of that country. And I thought it was just perfect to play it after Gary Bartz because I think we've all been liberated somewhat by Gary's conversation. That was wonderful. I'm so glad that worked out. Something that I wanted to play earlier, and I did not, and he will get a mention right now because he's playing locally in town at one of our wonderful, frequently haunted establishments, Club 347. Elliot Levine and Urban Groove. This is a little borrow from the Gap Band, Yearning for Your Love, on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
cry. Brother, 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 far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. No, no. You see, war is not the answer. Only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some understanding here today. Picket lines, picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Come talk to me, so you can see.
What's going on, Daryl? Oh, gracious. So nice to hear that song. I know a couple of folks in the chat room are agreeing. Daryl Walker with East Bay Soul from 2.0. What's going on? I don't know. I was inspired to play that song because of all that Gary Bartz has done through the years, and I know that he, if he has never heard that interpretation, would appreciate it from Daryl, because not a lot of folks have that right to sing that song, you know. But Daryl does, especially when he has that woo, little scream that he does that Griselda loves so much. Oh, the chat room's been really interesting today. Bless your hearts. Listen, something to consider about East Bay Soul. I'm really happy about this. They're certainly adding up the tour dates. And I'm a little excited. if you are listening to or looking at Facebook and keeping your ear out as far as what's coming up, you will see a little message from yours truly about a band looking for a place to play. I think that we've got it established. I know that it's just up to Mrs. Adams to make it happen. But we've been in communication, and there's going to be a big festival. It's one of those festivals that's all about what life is like in Maryland as far as seafood and music is concerned. Now, heretofore, they've had some very much contemporary jazz acts playing the stage, but East Bay Soul, from what I understand, is going to headline, and until I get more particulars, I'll just keep quiet. But in conjunction with that little visit that they're going to be doing in the summertime, we were thinking, wouldn't it be cool to have another gig to go to? So if they get to play this venue that we've been discussing, it'll be just off the chain, because this is one of the best venues I've ever seen anywhere in any state. Yeah. So keep your fingers crossed for that. Greg and the boys will be coming back to town. Yes, sir. Yeah. And we heard, too, what else? Elliot Levine and Urban Groove. And that was the Gap Band, Yearning for Your Love, and I was supposed to play that earlier but did not, from the Live Plus 7 CD. Elliot, the preferred pianist from Heat Wave. Whenever they're going to do a tour, they call Elliot in D.C. and say, could you come? And he usually obliges. But he's just one of those amazing people on the keyboard. You have to actually see him when he plays. But technologically, he is so much more advanced than most people I know. And his website will show you that when you delve into the history of Elliot Levine, you'll find out some things that are pretty staggering. Nobody else has a claim to them. Elliot does, as far as plays are concerned, via YouTube and what his personal preferences are for wanting to be heard in a certain way. He is one of the coolest cats I know, and certainly one of the best keyboardists, but there is more to him than meets the eye. Love his interpretations of songs, and on his Live Plus 7 CD, you should know that there are some very cool choices. The World is a Ghetto, No Rhyme, No Reason, Outstanding, For the Love of You, Moments in Love, like he does, like nobody else's business. So if you ever get a chance, wherever he's going to be, if Heatwave is in the area, know that Elliot will probably be with the group. And with that, I certainly want to get to a couple of more tracks because it's important. I promised. And I have to decide right now what I'm going to do. So let's just play it safe and play something that makes sense together. I want to get to a new track by Luis Munoz. And it's just a breathtaking track with vocals provided by one of my new friends on Facebook. So in order to do that, I have to dip down. It might take a little time because things are acting slow on this coffee-affected laptop, okay? I want to get to this by Pancho Sanchez and Terrence Blanchard. Terrence, by the way, did the music for the movie, if you saw it over the weekend, Betty and Coretta. It was wonderful. I can't say how impressed I was by Mary J. Blige. She was awesome. This is Jack's Dilemma from Chano y Dizzy on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Enjoy. Beautiful. I do love Luis Munoz and his new CD called Luz, and that is El Sueño de Adán, the vocal version. Oh, it's so beautiful. Adam Asarnau on piano, Tom Etchart on acoustic bass, Luis Munoz on percussion and background vocals, and hold on just a second.
Hey, Bill, I'll be right there.
I knew it was going to happen once during the show. And the vocalist, Tekka Penteresh. Yes, who has a site called newbossa.com. She's one of those beautiful, ethereal creatures who really loves Brazilian music. And you could just feel the whole vibe of that was just so magical. Amazing. Luis has a sizable project on his hands, and maybe we'll talk to Luis again next few weeks. We'll see about that. Pancho Sanchez and Terrence Blanchard, Mercy from Chano y Dizzy, all about Cuban-born Chano Pozo, who died at the age of 33, but in those 33 years, did that conguero have a life. Mercy affected so many people, including Dizzy Gillespie. So Pancho Sanchez thought it would be a great idea for his 25th CD for Concord Picante to get together and do some of his favorites, tap into the Dizzy songbook, and Pancho would take the part of Chano, Terrence Blanchard would take the part of Dizzy, and they would recreate some of that magic, and they did. Jack's Dilemma right there, and Pancho Sanchez will be at Vitello's coming up very soon. His website has the information. And again, Terrence Blanchard, if you can get a hold of that soundtrack music or see the movie, preferably, Betty and Coretta, he scored that Lifetime movie. It was just really wonderful. And I could leave you with a minute and a half song. I have one of them, but I think I'll keep Mark Prince and Albert for the next time around, if that's okay by you. Just so I can bail and talk to Bill downstairs about the mess that was there yesterday. Hopefully it will be different when I go downstairs now. So I'll just play this little outro music for you from Daoud Said and tell you about who's coming up. Winston Bird was supposed to do Tuesday, and he has to reschedule. He's going to be doing a TV show all next week. No, I can understand that. So coming up for you next Thursday, and I have somebody for Tuesday, but we'll have to wait and see. It could be a female saxophone player, and I'll just leave it at that. But coming up next Thursday, Valentine's Day, will be Tim Green, and in weeks ahead, it will be Daniel Domage from France. I'm actually learning a few words in French, and I'm also planning on talking to Bobby Humphrey in March because she's coming to the region, and she thought it would be cool if we could just do the Kvitz thing for a little bit. We'll be posting a picture of Bobby when she was in town a few years ago. She's an amazing lady. Also amazing, Gary Bartz, who spent some time with us that was real important for a lot of ears to hear in Baltimore and beyond. Just a beautiful creature inside and out, and I'm grateful to him. I'm grateful to everybody who listened today. Thank you, Blog Talk Radio, for the featured host aspect of the show. And we'll see you on Tuesday. Have a lovely weekend. We're still celebrating the Ravens here in town. Thank you. God bless you.